We're really focusing on outback landscapes today. Australia's rangelands, or the outback to many of us, covers almost 80% of the country. Now, a lot of that is run as grazing land under pastoral leases. Some of it's national parks and parts of it is under Indigenous land management. But there's a problem. It's becoming degraded and, broadly, people are leaving. So the challenge now is this: how to manage the rangelands for the benefit of the land as well as the people. Andrew Campbell of Charles Darwin University and Barry Trail of Outback Australia will share some ideas on that issue very soon. But first, let's meet some of the people who love living in Outback Australia. Anne Britton is a beef farmer and a photographer from Outback Queensland. Hi, Anne.
G'day, Cameron. How are you going?
Good. Where exactly are you?
We're just outside of Boulia, halfway between Sydney and Darwin. If you're looking at a map of Australia, we're about there.
Can you describe that landscape for me?
It's channel country, very, very flat, and with lots of channels in between the flat, naturally treeless plains. Lots of trees where there's naturally water, but rather flat in between, with a few hills here and there. We don't see many hills.
So this way,
Cameron.
This is the sort of country I imagine you can stand out under big skies and see it raining a long way away, and still be bathed in sunshine with no clouds about your property.
That's it. Yeah. That's what you can see. Beautiful. The crisper and the cooler the morning, the further you can see, and it's just totally amazing just how far the naked eye can see on some mornings. It's even having lived out here for 30 years, it still amazes me anyway.
It's tough country though. Why are you out there?
I love it. I just think it's amazing country. It's a country that you have to learn from. You can't control it. You have to learn from it to live out here, I would say. And it's just the harshness of it and the beauty of it. I think the positives outweigh the negatives. You know, it can be extremely, extremely harsh. But the beauty is there, even in hard times, the beauty is there as well. So I'm not too sure. I suppose
there's something more than the beauty, though, isn't there? Because this is, people fall in love with this part of Australia.
Yeah, I don't know. I've written blogs about it, trying to explain it, that I think you're just part of. You just feel, when you come home, you feel so part of it. It's hard to explain. It's sort of as if you belong. You belong here. It makes you breathe easy. I'm assuming if people haven't had this experience themselves about country where they've gone, it might be hard for them to imagine that. But, you just become part of the land and you at one with it. Would that make sense, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to discuss some of the challenges to protecting the landscape and keeping people there a little later. So stay with us, Anne Britton,
yep,
who is a beef farmer and a photographer in Outback Queensland. Peter Bryant's also with me. Peter's a retired farmer from the far west of New South Wales. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What was the landscape like where you farmed?
It's the landscape changed massively in the area that I came from. It just depended on what section you were in. There were river flats, there were river plains, there were Gibber Hills and Mulga country and red sandy country, flooded Cuttabara channels and other channels that came out of the Paroo and the Darling. It was immensely different.
What did you love about that country? Because some people love hills and trees, not so much the harshness of the country you're describing.
I didn't regard the country as being harsh. It was remote, and it was a very tranquil place. It was also a very challenging place, but it was a challenge that we accepted very readily. And we had really hard times, and we had really good times, and it was something that after a while, you learnt to roll with the punches a bit. You never expected the good times to continue forever. You always planned during the good times for the bad times.
Peter, you should give us the actual location. I said Far West New South Wales. Where exactly are we talking?
Well, I'm talking about an area about 100 miles west-southwest of Bourke.
So remote
between
stuff.
Louth and Wanarring. Wanarring on the Paroo River and Louth on the Darling River.
So were you running sheep?
We ran sheep and we ran some cattle, mainly sheep.
You referred to the challenges of farming out that way. I use the term farming loosely in this context. What were those challenges?
Well, the challenges, number one, was remoteness. If we had stock for sale, for instance, we mainly tried to sell our stock on the ground, so an agent would bring buyers out and have a look and maybe agree on a price or maybe not. If we sold cattle, mainly we put those cattle on trucks and we sent them to a market, maybe Forbes, maybe Dubbo, but usually the closest market so that we avoided too much transport.
But why did you stay there? Why did you decide that was the place for you, given the ups and the downs and the challenges to running an operation there?
Well, there's a bit of a historic relevance there. My mother was born in that country, and her parents were there for a considerable time before that. So it was really history, but I was sent away to school after having correspondence at home, and then when I came back, there were several things I would have liked to have done. I'm matriculated, and I could have done law or economics or something else.
Something secure and
the
higher
land
paid.
Just got me. Yeah. The land just grabbed me.
So when Anne described it as being able to breathe and something bigger than just physically being there, do you relate to how she was describing the experience?
Absolute freedom.
Well, we're talking history. I'll bring in Daniel Oates at this point. Daniel's from the Kimberley Land Council. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. How are you going?
Good. We've described the Kimberley a little bit in some detail so far. What is it you love about the Kimberley?
Well, I suppose a particular part that I sort of live in and help sort of to coordinate and manage is a part of the northern tip of the Dampier Peninsula, and I suppose you can't get away from the change of the tides that sort of change the landscape sort of every 6 hours a lot of the time. Definitely the savannah woodlands, the Pindan, and the white sandy beaches and mangrove creeks and reefs that we've got here on the coastline. Yeah.
So it's beautiful. Is it harsh country as well?
Well, I suppose some people... Yeah, it might have been a bit harsh for all the Bardi ancestors a long time ago when, they would have known a lot of about the water access and things like that. But, it's very rich in, the saltwater resources and bush fruit resources. So, there's always something to eat from the ocean, and a lot of the traditional owners sort of talk about the ocean being their supermarket as such. Yeah.
Anne and Peter both describe some of the challenges to grazing industries from where they're based. That's actually led to some people leaving the land, leaving the outback regions or the pastoral regions of the rangeland regions of Australia. There's also Indigenous people moving from the more remote regions to main centres. What's driving that change?
Well, I suppose there was a big outstation movement in the sort of early 90s, and some funding for people to go back to country, and some people took that opportunity, and some people have been making the best of that opportunity despite having to be off the grid power and those sort of things and travel from the major communities every day sort of thing. But I suppose, jobs. People all need to feed their families, and there's quite a lot lack of jobs in the communities, and they need to go to the larger towns like Broome and to Derby to maybe get better education for their kids or better sort of lifestyle. What they sort of perceive as that, yeah.
What are the consequences of the way the land's looked after or managed when you see that drift of people from more remote places to the regional centres?
Well, I work in Indigenous lands management here, and I suppose one of the big challenges is people not being on there to you know, to look after their little patch of country, and that includes the appropriate fire management. So we do get uncontrolled fires coming through, but, you know, through land management groups like the Bardigo Rangers, the Nyulun Rangers out of Beagle Bay, we're sort of trying to reintroducing better fire management into the country, which sort of has flow-on effects into a lot of other biodiversity management as well.
Mm. You're hearing there from Daniel Oates from the Kimberley Land Council. I've also been chatting with Peter Bryant, who's a retired farmer from the far west of New South Wales, and also Anne Britton, who's a beef farmer and photographer from outback Queensland. And we're discussing the question, how do we look after and protect the rangelands in Australia, or the outback regions of Australia? At this point, I'd like to bring in Barry Trail, who's from Outback Australia, the Pew Charitable Trust, and also Professor Andrew Campbell, who's the Director of the Research Institute for the Environment and Livelihoods. That's based at Charles Darwin University. Thank you to both of you. Andrew, I'll start with you. Traditionally, for white Australians, it's been the grazing industry that's led to the outback areas being populated and the land being managed. How viable is that now?
Morning, Cameron. Well, the rangelands is a very big place, and there are many different regions within it. And some of those, like where Anne comes from in the Channel Country, can still have very, very good years and be extremely productive. But overall, there are certainly many rangelands regions where it's a struggle to be profitable year in, year out, and where it really helps to have low or no debt and some other sources of income so that you can survive in those years where you don't have the right combination of a good season with good prices and the ability to get your product to market. So there are a lot of challenges that farmers elsewhere aren't up against to the same degree.
But has that changed over the years? The ability for people to remain viable on the land?
No, I don't think it's changed dramatically. I think it's always been a tough gig, but as both Anne and Peter have said, it's got enormous compensations as well.
The technical definition, I guess, of the rangelands would be the country that's too dry, or the rainfall's too unreliable, or the soil's too poor for cropping to take place. But that's a technical definition. How do you describe it?
That is the technical definition. For me, I just think it as the, you know, the outback country, the big open spaces. I don't have a technical definition in mind when I'm thinking about it. I think about big skies,
red dirt,
and vast horizons.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think of it as well. Even though there is this technical agricultural definition, if you like. Barry Trail, what's happening in outback Australia at the moment with populations?
Well, I think listening to Anne reminded me, Cameron, of something one of her near neighbours, Kelsey Nielsen, told me a few years ago. Kelsey's a grazier near Boolia. And she said to me, Barry, as a conservationist, what you need to focus on is helping keep people in the country, because not everyone wants to live in remote Australia in the outback. And she was right. She was absolutely right. And not only for the people side of the equation, but often overlooked, it's for the wildlife and for the country side of the equation, because the country and wildlife need people on it to manage it. As Daniel said, you know, referring to, you know, to deal with fire, to stop uncontrolled wildfires, to deal with invasive species, you know, feral animals, all sorts of problem species that are now out there, we need people on the ground. And one of the huge issues across the board is that there are fewer and fewer people for a range of reasons. It varies from region to region, but for a range of reasons, there's less people on the countryside, less people in the outback.
Is that in part because it's harder, or it's becoming more difficult to make a grazing enterprise viable, keep it viable?
Well, I think it's a story of it varies between regions, but certainly there's some quality country, as Andrew said, there's some quality pastoral country like the Channel Country where Anne is, like the Barkly Tablelands, Victoria River Downs, etc. But there are many pastoral districts, regions, properties which were always on the edge commercially, and which were clearly now not commercially viable. And so a lot of those are now going out of pastoralism and in a haphazard way going into tourism. Some of them are carbon farming. Some of them have been bought back by Aboriginal landowners. Some have been bought by conservation organisations. And some of them have even been purchased as lifestyle blocks, you know, the big equivalent of a weekender down the coast. In combination, I think that's actually good, because we need more diversification of enterprises back in the outback, in those districts, because, you know, for many of those properties, it's not commercially viable to run stock anymore. So that's the future, and I think the key thing is we need to start really thinking much more systematically and effectively about supporting people who are going that extra yard.
If you can remove the stock but keep the people, is that a good outcome? There is this argument that livestock do environmental damage.
I think that varies from site to site. You know, a well-run property, I think, you know, you can get a viable enterprise and that sort of the environment is looked after. What I think that probably needs to be focused more is not so much on those quality properties, as I said, but on the country that is marginal, is in pastoral leases legally, but in practice isn't pastoral anymore. And also, just to throw in, I think the other huge positive change that's happened quietly, fairly quietly over the last 10 years, which you know, Daniel and the Bardi-Jarri Rangers have been part of, is huge areas of Aboriginal owned land, much of which was never in much of it which never ran cattle, is now fully back with Aboriginal landowners, and it's going into Indigenous protected areas, parks on Aboriginal lands, and ranger programs which are looking after that country.
I guess the challenge there is to make sure there is an income stream for that type of land management.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think we're at the sort of, I think the early stages of what I certainly hope, and you know, my own organisation's been working to support, is getting a mixture of government dollars, business dollars, carbon farming dollars, which are very real and are happening on the ground, to people like the Bardi Rangers, Wardikin Rangers, other Aboriginal groups who are doing just a superb job on the ground looking after country.
Daniel Oates from the Kimberley Land Council, how difficult is it to translate this work on the ground into income for people?
Well, it wouldn't be, I suppose, possible without the help and support of the Australian Government Working on Country Program and an Indigenous Protected Areas Program, which is lucky that we've got, you know, secured funding for the next few years. But obviously we are looking at, as Barry said, those extra opportunities to add value and other funding sources and also other funding streams to keep these programs happening, because, I mean, you know, it is expensive to operate on country, and we don't always want to have to be relying on that funding, but it is a huge benefit to have that in the bag as such. And like we mentioned, carbon. And, you know, we've been getting some good incomes in the North Kimberley and through Northern Australia, but some of the other areas have just been starting to look at that, and there is an opportunity. But, we're you know, disappointed where that might not be the case in the future with the change in price on carbon.
What would that mean to the efforts that are happening on the ground, to the people that are out there trying to manage the land, if the change in price in carbon or the change in government policy means that there's no income?
Well, I mean, we'd probably be doing it anyway, but it would mean that, you know, those sort of... And basically we'd be generating our own income to continue to do appropriate fire management on country, but it just means that capacity building would sort of stay at a bit of a standstill, and other things, you know, you'd sort of, because it would be quite significant funds to those land management groups, and also capacity for those Aboriginal prescribed body corporates who are essentially in control of native title lands.
On Bush Telegraph, we're discussing how to manage the Australia's rangelands, particularly given, in parts, there's a dwindling population as it becomes more difficult for some people to make a living in the harsh environment of Australia's outback, or rangelands, if you prefer. And Britton, you work on the land, a beef farmer. You're in a part of Queensland that I'd say is patchy at the moment. Some of it's in a really tough place, climate-wise. Are you seeing people leave the land around you?
Not around here so much, Cameron. We haven't seen people leaving around here. The weather-wise, it has been certainly very patchy. The rain that we received in 2013 basically wouldn't have added anything negative or positive to the land. It was basically no rain whatsoever. So our last lot of rain around this way, we had about 30-odd mils in July 2012, and our next lot of rain after that was about 70 mils over four falls in February, March this year. We've had a further 13 mils. This is all storm rain.
Mm-hmm.
Some people receive storm rain, and, of course, storm rain is patchy. We were fortunate to be under this, and again, patchy. Out towards the Georgina, they received wonderful rainfall, absolutely amazing rainfall, and good luck to them, and other people haven't received any at all. So
that's what this country's like, though. When you get it, when it's a good year, it's a good year, but then you miss out for a long time. Yeah?
Yes, and people that live out here and come to this country, it's a known fact. It's what you have to live with. We have a few people around our table when we're doing our management program. We can have as many management programs as we like in place, but good old Mother Nature is there too, and she just doesn't like forthcoming with information too early. So we have to deal with that, and we know that there's always got to be that plan B if she doesn't turn up on time with her wet season or things like that. And the last few summers have been extremely hot. We're having a winter this year, which I think it might be mind over matter, but we actually are having a winter, which I'm hoping might bring on a wet season, a nice wet season. So we really only have two seasons out here, so that is what I'm hoping. But no, we haven't seen people leave. I'm not saying that they're not. Some people would be in very tight situations, given not only the Mother Nature climate around here, but also the decisions that are made upon us while we're living out here and trying to make our business work as well. So
what decisions are you talking about? What type of things? What decisions?
Oh, our land rentals is a huge thing for us. I believe they have frozen them from going up, which is absolutely marvellous. We class this as our business. It is our business. We're on leased land, so we pay money for the land and then we pay our leases. But we'd like to think that, as well as ourselves, lots of other people actually take care of the land. So the land rentals that were going up and going up were going to make us unviable, you know. So
have the changing economics of agriculture made farming where you are tougher?
Yeah, some decisions have. I suppose there's a broad range of decisions that all come into play. But I think that one would be the biggest on top of the list at the moment, for us anyway, and where we are. So as it was said before by Barry, what Kelsey said, you know, the people that want to live out here want to live out here. They want to make this their business. Lots of them know the country, and those that want to move into this country are willing to learn to make it work because they do love it. And we do class it as a business. I think it's just if people could understand, we don't want sympathy, we don't want handouts, but if you could just understand and just put a bit of common sense behind what we are up against out this way, and in many parts of Australia that are trying to, we've proven that we can be viable, and we know we're up against Mother Nature, but if we're just given a little bit, you know, loosen that rope around us every now and again to make people realise that it's magnificent country, absolutely magnificent. We do give a lot of money to the economy. It's not as if we don't help boost the Australian economy, and I say that with the utmost respect and a lot of pride, the beef industry out this way. So if people could just, people making decisions, if they could just listen to those that have actually been here and done that, we're happy to be here. We're happy to make a business out of it. We love living here. Lots of people do. You know,
just like, got to make the figures stack up, hey?
Yeah. You know, don't try and, like, what good is it if you make us unviable and we leave the land? It's going to be, we'd like to think that we manage it for the better. Like, we received that 70 mils of rain and we were able to fatten our cattle because the cattle that were left, we managed it so that when that we did get 70 mils of rain, the country just responded absolutely, just wonderfully, you know.
Peter Bryant, if I can go to Peter Bryant, you described earlier, Peter, how that area of far western New South Wales also went from boom to bust. You're out of the industry now, but do you get a sense that it's got harder since you left?
No, I don't think it's got harder. I think it's pretty much the same. I think the emphasis has changed a little from time to time. When I left the land, the wool industry itself was struggling because it wasn't the terms of trade were not brilliant for selling wool. But since then, we've had a massive turnaround in the price of sheep. So even merinos are selling at a really wonderful price in the sale yards in the central west here. So, you know, in the cattle prices, when I left the Western Division, the cattle prices were a long way lower than they are now. So I think it is a boom and bust country, but you've got to try and organise yourself into a level playing field so that you do not take advantage of the boom seasons with masses of amounts of influx of stock or whatever. You conserve whatever you've got out there as far as possible and put aside resources for the future. You just cannot, you've got to try and run an average operation.
So echoing what Andrew Campbell said yes. earlier about the it's always been tough. Andrew, do we need to consider perhaps new options, new ways of people keeping people on the land, whether that's a system of stewardship payments or something different?
Yeah, I think we do, Cameron, and I think it's important. We've been focusing on the grazing industries, but you know, we've got minerals and energy, tourism, conservation and Indigenous land uses that are very important in the rangelands too. And from a public policy perspective, we need to think about that whole mix and how it works. So, yes, I think we should be pricing, to use the economist jargon, pricing externalities, which means rewarding people for doing the right thing, but also ensuring that we extract the right price. You know, we can only dig up and sell our energy resources or our mineral resources once, and it's really important that the public gets an appropriate return on that and that we think about how some of that gets returned out to the country from which the resources came.
But isn't one of the key differences here in a resources industry, we see an influx of people that work while the money's there and then they go, and in the grazing industry we talk about generations that stay on the land and learn the land and manage the land?
Yeah, that's what I meant about a public policy sort of framework. We need to think about risk and who bears it, the legacy issues. So, I mean, the NT government now is trying to work out what to do with Nhulunbuy, with the aluminium refinery closing down. We need to think about where we want FIFO and where we want permanent populations and then how to best support those, but also who does bear the risk when things go wrong. We've got more than 1,000 legacy mines dealing with just here in the NT. And they're imposing costs on the broader society, and the companies that generated those problems are no longer around. So we have to think about that overall framework, and if we can do it in such a way that it rewards people for being on country, whether they're in grazing industries or conservation industries or tourism, and frankly, I don't think our rangelands tourism has had a strategic refit since Crocodile Dundee.
But, Andrew, are we at the point where perhaps some people running a grazing industry on really marginal land in areas you think they maybe should not be, should we pay them to go and let a new industry move in?
I'd be looking at paying people to produce certain outcomes, and that'd be control of weeds and ferals and appropriate fire regimes and looking after the most important habitats and the water resources, and that could well be done in conjunction with the grazing operation. So run stock on the better country and manage the rest of it for those broader values. There's also really important cultural values. There are very few places on earth left like the Australian rangelands, Cameron, and I think the broader society needs to understand that Australia's got this amazing asset and we should be investing in it.
Very, very quickly, Barry Trail, what would be a major change that would go some way to preserving Australia's rangelands?
I think Andrew, did a very good broad summary of that, Cameron. The key thing is we need people on the country, we need to support them. And that's not as if we're coming from a blank slate where that's not already happening. As Daniel said, the Working on Country program, which is supporting Aboriginal groups, rangers on the ground to deliver environmental services for all Australians, that's already working. We need to expand that, increase that, and potentially also look for stewardship payments outside that as well.
Left us with a lot to think about. Barry, thank you. Barry Trail is the Director of Outback Australia, the Pew Charitable Trust. You also heard from Professor Andrew Campbell, Director of the Research Institute for the Environment and Livelihoods. That's at Charles Darwin University. And my thanks also to Daniel Oates from the Kimberley Land Council, Peter Bryant, who's a retired farmer. He ran sheep and cattle in the far west of New South Wales, and Anne Britton as well, who runs beef and works as a photographer in Outback Queensland. That's the program for today.